Hey everybody, welcome to the Spillers After Show podcast. This episode is me, Spillers co-host Brian Dunn, reading my short story Eel Sauce Blues live at Spillers number 6 on December 13th, 2016. Here's Robert with my introduction.
Every so often, Brian and I wonder how much we've improved as a result of hearing all of these fantastic writers all of the time. And to test that out, we're going to stick one of us up on stage this evening. It's not me. I'm going to do it next time, though. So we're going to turn the spotlight on ourselves for a moment. And I'm going to bring up the Spillers co-host and humor writer, Mr. Brian Dunn. His short fiction has been in Shotgun Honey, The Oddville Press, and Rock Bottom Journal. His humor writing has been in McSweeney's Internet Tendency and Splitsider. He is a big jazz fan, he is an old friend of mine, and he is a reformed trumpet player, and that fact is important. Mr. Brian Dunn.
This is a story I wrote expressly for tonight, and it is entitled Eel Sauce Blues. Frank Zappa once said, "Jazz isn't dead, it just smells funny." Back when I led my Desert Dogs big band, jazz reeked of Kung Pao chicken. Our only steady gig was the Jade Dragon, a Szechuan Chinese food restaurant in downtown Phoenix, Arizona, off 3rd Street, sandwiched between a dry cleaner's and bridal dress shop. Yi, the restaurant's owner, was a rabid jazz fan. Told me he grew up listening to his dad's Harry James and Benny Goodman albums, drumming along on his school notebook, a pair of number 2 pencils for sticks. The guy loved jazz enough to squeeze all 15 of us into the Jade Dragon's banquet room once a week, just out of sight of diners who only wanted to eat their tea-smoked duck in peace. The banquet room might have been spacious enough for mid-sized family gatherings or even regional sales meetings, but when asked to house 12 horns and a full rhythm section, Carnegie Hall, it wasn't. No room for a proper piano, I was forced to play the shitty Casio keyboard I'd originally bought to accompany jugglers and clowns at children's birthday parties. Its console was forever streaked with blue clown makeup, the mark of my brief scuffle with Puddles over payment terms. On the other side of the banquet's back wall was the kitchen, which raised the room's temperature a good 20 degrees. Pots and woks clanged away behind us like a percussionist with poor impulse control. In exchange for enduring these accommodations and playing 2 sets of jazz, we ate from the Jade Dragon's buffet for free. I'm talking all the bonbon chicken a big band can shove down its collective gullet during one 30-minute break. That was the negotiated deal. Soon after we started gigging there, I wrote a chart for the band called Yee's Groove. If Yee dug how we played it on a particular night, he looked the other way while we filled up to-go boxes on our way out the door. The Desert Dogs played so many Jade Dragon gigs that the restaurant's pungent aromas had imprinted themselves on our music folders. If you closed your eyes and pressed the baritone saxophone book to your nose, you'd swear you were at the world's largest Kung Pao festival held every year way down south in Tupelo. Bobby Paulson played lead trumpet for me then. He kept an extra pair of boxer briefs in his trumpet case, rolled up and stuffed next to the valve oil, in case he should shit himself during a gig. It's a thing lead trumpet players do, the backup underwear. They have to play the high loud stuff guys like me write for them, and if their internal compression gets a little sideways with so much as a biscuit in their belly, well, an extra pair of drawers is a real gig saver. Every 6 months or so, a new cautionary tale would make the rounds about some poor cat in a town like Duluth trying to take things up an octave and fouling his briefs instead. I laughed like hell at those stories. Trumpet players are a cocky bunch, and anything that knocks one of them down a peg or two is cool by me. The possibility that Bobby might soil himself on the bandstand was the only leg up I'd ever have on the guy. He'd been blessed with superior genetics, shoulders made for landing jet planes on, hair destined to remain dark and lush. Round-shouldered, thin-haired guys like me have been losing women to guys like him since clubbing females over the head fell out of vogue. I tolerated Bobby for 2 years because he played my lead book better than anyone else in town. I overlooked his peacock strutting and prima donna attitude, the fact he made more money than I'd ever see. Yeah, I swallowed all that shit. Then he slept with my girlfriend, Jill. Jill played second trombone in my band. She was a little thing who would have looked more at home in the flute section of a symphony orchestra than hoisting a big hunk of brass amid a dozen sweaty men, but she possessed perfect pitch and an encyclopedic knowledge of jazz that rivaled any of the guys. I won her over the way you do any female musician. You write the prettiest little background figures in the second trombone book for her to play, secret solos for an audience of 2. After Jill played them, she'd take the trombone off her face to reveal a bright red ring above her top lip, the telltale sign of too much mouthpiece pressure. One night after the gig, we talked music, then other things, and then made a date. 6 months later, I thought Jill and I had the potential to be one of those annoying artsy couples, the kind that play vinyl records in the house and cover the dining room table with crafts. It took less than 24 hours after sleeping with Bobby for Jill to tearfully confess. She recounted the entire evening, leaving out the sex details, but including the post-coital pillow talk. She was honest that way. I didn't tell her I'd take her back, but I didn't say I wouldn't either. Later, when I confronted Bobby man-to-man over a beer, he just shrugged his shoulders in a boys will be boys gesture. I was lost for what to do next, so I took a long pull on my Budweiser. He looked at me as though I was keeping him from something more important. So, we're good? Bobby asked. And this Thursday at the Dragon, right? I told him, sure, we were good. I told him, yeah, we were on for Thursday night. I didn't tell him I knew from Jill that Bobby Paulson was stricken with a batshit crazy fear of eels. Any phallic-shaped slithering animal, really, but definitely eels. The next Thursday at the J Dragon was a mid-July triple-digit scorcher. Jill had called in a sub. Some greasy kid from the community college with a trombone players have big slides sticker on his case was going to be playing those exquisite background figures I'd written only for her. Bobby got out of schlepping the band's equipment from my Econoline van by sitting in his parked BMW, air conditioning cranked, while he buzzed on his mouthpiece. After the rest of us looked like we carried a Coco Bolo desk up three flights of stairs, Bobby made his unhurried entrance in a white golf shirt and pressed khaki pants. "What's with the sub?" Bobby asked. Without waiting for an answer, he slipped into the back row where the other trumpet stood and waited for my downbeat. I kicked off the band with our standard opener, and my ears picked it up right away. Bobby had come to play. He was swinging the band like crazy, soaring above the other horns, nailing every phrase. I guess sleeping with another man's girlfriend did right by the guy. On the second chart, he held over the last note, cutting off a full beat after the rest of the band. Lead trumpet player's prerogative, he called it. I usually found the practice maddening, but it did light a fire under the band that night. They dug into the charts harder than I'd heard in a long time, even the ballads. When we polished the first set off with an up-tempo piece I'd written to feature the sax section, Bobby took the last lick up an octave for the hell of it. This prompted a woo from Greg, my lead tenor saxophone, who turned around and gave Bobby a thumbs up. Break time, someone yelled. It might have been the sub. I dismissed the band with a wave of my hand. They made their way to the buffet, but Bobby hung back, still holding his horn, self-satisfied smile across his mug. I'd seen that same smile when I confronted Bobby about sleeping with Jill. He tried to wipe it away, but it had lingered just long enough. I reached into my music bag, grabbed the sheets, and walked up to Bobby. "Something sounds pretty good back here tonight," I said. Bobby grinned. "Not something, someone. I'm on fire back here." I waved a piece of sheet music under his nose. "Wrote a new chart. It's a feature for you." Bobby's eyebrow arched in interest. "A feature?" "Yep, yep, and it's a blues, because I know you like a good blues." "Man, I love a good blues. Hey, I even gave you a nice shout chorus at the end. Sounds killer. You up for running through it tonight? What with you being on fire and all?" Bobby considered it, and in that second of contemplation, I feared he would veto the idea with a dismissive nod. Instead, he said, "Hell yeah, I'm gonna nail the shit out of this thing. Let's do it." Then he looked at me with as much sincerity as a liar can muster. "Hey, listen, about what happened with me and Jill." "Water under the bridge," I said. "She and I weren't going anywhere anyway." "Cool," Bobby said. He grabbed the sheet music from me and gave it a glance. "Weird title." He tucked the music into the back of his folder, then shoved his trumpet into its case and walked out of the banquet room. I slipped the parts for the chart into the back of the other players' folders before walking into the dining room for a little veggie fried rice. I sat in a booth next to Ernie, my lead alto saxophonist. Ernie's claim to fame was once taking a leak next to drummer Elvin Jones in the men's room of the Blue Note in New York. I picked up my rice. Ernie talked about seeing Art Blakey play live in Sioux Falls, and Bobby piled his plate high with beef and broccoli. He went back a second time, then a third. Bobby looked a bit peaked as he pulled out his horn for our second set. Usually we'd start out with a medium tempo shuffle just to ease into things, but I called a chops buster. Bobby acquitted himself pretty well at the beginning, but clammed the final phrase, dropping out on the last note and leaving a hole in the chord. I shot him a look, but he pointed to his trumpet as if to say, "It's the horn's fault, not mine." I just smiled. I called every brutal, lip-wrecking chart in our book. I tweaked tempos to maximize the effort expended, and I started to witness something I didn't think was possible. I watched Bobby Paulson falter. He kept the horn on his face, even as his chops were betraying him, but Bobby was overmatched. Halfway through the set, he burped into his fist, then took a huge gulp of water from the bottle of Evian on his music stand. I kept the band at it until the Jade Dragon banquet room reeked of man's sweat and Dan Dan noodles, and it was past time to shut things down for the night. "One more," I said. "Something new. It's in the back of your folders." "Aw, come on," said my drummer. "This is a clear union violation," said my baritone saxophonist. "Only if you were in a union," I said. The guys pulled out their parts to Eel Sauce Blues. "Weird title," my bass player said, plucking his D string. Bobby flipped to the last page of his part and grimaced. I'd written the shout chorus just out of his working range. To no one in particular, I yelled, "Thanks for being a great crowd. We're going to close out with something I wrote for our lead trumpet player and all-around great guy, Bobby Paulson." Somewhere in the dining room, a plate dropped to the floor and shattered. I smiled and counted off a nice, easy tempo. I'll tell you this about Bobby. He gave that chart a hell of a try. Even managed to navigate the melody I'd written to purposely trip him up. He stuck mostly to stock blues licks during his solo, but a few original ideas crept in. When he wrapped up his solo, Greg launched into his, and I gave Bobby a quick nod of approval before deciding the beef and broccoli had done their thing. The shout chorus started, and Bobby buried his face in the music. I slipped into the dining room, sprinted past the tables and booths, and slid into the kitchen, where earlier that day the head chef let me store a live 4-foot eel in a plastic tub for $50. I ripped off the lid and grabbed the slippery bastard with both arms. I ran into the banquet room. My heart thudded. My temples pulsed. I couldn't hear my own band, even though I knew they were wailing. The eel sensed something was terribly wrong and thrashed against me in panic. Bobby nailed the high F nice and clean. He hit the G sharp above that, but his tone thinned immediately. He clammed the high A. Bobby braced for the last phrase, the one I'd written for him to never play, while my band roared toward the music's climax. Then I launched the eel. They told me later the eel impacted with enough force to drive the mouthpiece on Bobby's horn straight to the back of his throat. His two upper teeth shattered, shards of which showed up in his stomach during the autopsy. But the kicker happened after Bobby tumbled backward and smashed his head against the wall. That caused what they called involuntary peristalsis. Yep, Bobby Paulson's last act as my elite trumpet player was to evacuate 3 plates of beef and broccoli from his digestive tract into his pants. Those emergency boxer briefs never so much as made it out of the poor bastard's trumpet case.
That was me, Brian Dunn, reading my short story, Eel Sauce Blues, at Spillers No. 6 at Crescent Ballroom on December 13th, 2016. For more Spillers After Show podcast episodes, please go to spillersaftershow.com. For more information on Spillers, Phoenix, Arizona's premier short fiction storytelling event, go to spillers.net.